This is Near FM
90.3.
Oh, good to have you all here. 5 o'clock on a Monday, yes, live, Studio One, and probably the hottest day we've ever had in Ireland. Although the sun isn't even fully out, and it's still one of those really hot days. So anyway, hope you're enjoying it. Maybe you're there by the beach with your little tranny radio listening to all this. Anyway, we got a packed show today, and today, believe it or not, is our 250th episode. Been here a while, that makes about 5 years, and it's been a pleasure and an honour to do it, and I have great memories from Paul Caffrey, who was with me for the first few years, and I hope to get Paul back in the show soon. We miss him here, of course, and hi to you, Paul, if you're listening. And also to our other regular listeners, God bless you all, and thanks for tuning in. So that was a great last programme we had from Andrea Splendori and the Rugby Lads, and some of you may have seen that Ireland did an amazing victory over the All Blacks at the weekend. I think the big one, of course, is next week, see who's the best between the two. So they really played a cracker of a game. I saw some of the highlights, not the live thing, but it was brilliant the way they played. So that lifts the spirits, doesn't it? And but then we talk about not just temporarily lifting your spirit, but eternally lifting the spirit, because we talk about the things of God here, the one who made you, the one who loves you, the one who's paid everything for your life. And today we're looking at two different things. Actually, I wanted to continue a little bit from what we were talking about last week, which is Jonah. Now, boy, Jonah, what a story. Anyone who ever went to school would remember the story of Jonah and the whale, okay? But when you read the book of Jonah, which isn't particularly long, it's there in the Bible. And if you don't have a Bible, you can Google it and you can read it on your smartphone. And so the book of Jonah, anyway, there's four parallels that I saw between Jonah and Jesus. The first one being that he came from Nazareth. The second one, that he slept in a boat in the middle of a storm, just like Jesus did. The third one, he calmed the sea. Well, it kind of calmed the sea. It's when they tossed him in the water, the sea went calm. And of course, a bit of Jesus just spoke to the sea and it calmed. Remember that one. And then finally, 3 days and three nights in the belly of the fish. That was Jonah. And Jesus himself said, just like Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the fish, so too will I be in the belly of the earth. Speaking about being in the nether regions when he died, Jesus. So there's amazing parallels between them there. So the story, of course, with Jonah was that God called him to go one way. He went the other way, ran away, a bit scared of the Ninevites, scary dudes they were. And but eventually, when the storm arose and he was woken up, and the guy said, pray to your God. And they realized that, hey, it was because of Jonah's disobedience that they were nearly going to die in that boat. So they tossed him over, and he died, I believe, in the bottom of the ocean, scooped up by a whale, resurrected, came out, spat out, vomited up, began to preach. Boy, that caused a bit of attention, didn't it, in the city of Nineveh, this guy with probably seaweed still wrapped around his neck and a certain aroma coming from him. And but the word he preached was a real simple one. It wasn't a kind of a 3-point sermon with a kind of a simple plan of salvation laid out. He just said this. He said 40 more days and Nineveh will be overthrown. And the record shows that he went throughout the whole city saying this. So he must have said it many a time. 40 more days and Nineveh will be overthrown. So easy enough to remember a message like that. So Jonah did that. And then what did he do? He parked himself on a hill, watched over the city and waited for the judgment of God to fall on Nineveh. And guess what? It didn't happen. Because the people of Nineveh, they repented. They turned from their sin. The entire city, from the poorest people first right up to the king, they realized, the king himself said, let everyone call urgently on God, and let them give up their evil ways and their violence. Now, they were known as a very violent people, but they were ready to turn from their violence, to turn from their evil ways, to turn to the living God. And God had mercy upon them. Now, this really annoyed Jonah, because Jonah was waiting for judgment. And I'm just going to read you a wee bit here. And the story at the very end of Jonah is a very interesting story, because as he was sitting there, getting baked by the sun on the hilltop, God caused a plant to grow up to shade him, and he kind of said, oh, thanks Lord for that one. And then next day God caused a worm to come up and swallow up and kill the plant, so he got a bit of sunburn on the top of his head, and so he was a bit angry at God for that one. And then at the end God said to him, this is wild, and said, and the Lord said, you have had pity on the plant for which you have not laboured, nor made it grow, which came up in the night and perished in the night. And should I not pity Nineveh, that great city, in which are more than 120,000 persons who cannot discern between their right hand and their left, and much livestock? So, this is wild. We've often heard that phrase, haven't we, about not being able to know your right hand from your left. And that comes straight out of the Bible, from the book of Jonah, as I just read. And the picture is very graphic. Imagine having looking at your left hand, and then you put out your right hand and you look at it, and you don't know one from the other. Well, talk about a state of confusion and being completely lost mentally. And that's why God described the people of Nineveh. And sometimes God is a God of great compassion. And he looks down on the city of Dublin, and even northeast Dublin, and says, these people don't know their left hand from the right. And yet, it's mercy that God extends. So that when people turn to him, we have that assurance, that promise of God's forgiveness and God's mercy. And I think there's a lot of hope in those messages, because we, in the back of our heads, sometimes we think, oh, you got to be intellectual. You got to understand a whole bunch of stuff. You got to go to Bible college and learn things before you get near God. It's not like that. God reached out to a people who didn't know their left hand from their right. So it wasn't about knowledge. It was about a heart that turns to God. There you go. So I thought I'd tell you a little bit about Jonah there, and hopefully whet your appetite to go read it yourself and see a great, great story there. A story that really happened, of course, because Jesus spoke about it, and it wasn't a parable. It was a reality. It happened, and it's got great lessons for us today. So you're listening to God Talk, Anthony Brabazon here, and I'm here every Monday, of course, for half an hour. And if you want any of our prior programs, just go on to the Near FM website, and what you can do is look at the Listen Again section, and you get all our previous programs. And also, if you want to contact us by text, it's 087-979-5454. If you're on Twitter, it's at Near FM God Talk. On the web, it's godtalkradioblog.wordpress.com. And if you like some of the music we play, put them up on Spotify, and you just key in there, Songs from God Talk, and you get some really good music, which will be inspiring. So, anyway, thought I'd wrap up Jonah with that. But I want to move over now. And we're moving across the wee water, across the Irish Sea, to the town, or the country of Wales. And we're going back, of course, going back about, I think it's about 200 years we're going back here. We're going back to a chap called Christmas Evans. What a name. Well, he got the name because he was born on the 25th of December. So they call him Christmas Evans. And he was born in Cardiganshire in Wales, and his father was a shoemaker. But the father died early, and the boy grew up as an illiterate farm labourer. And at the age of 17, he became a servant of a Presbyterian minister called David Davies. And the reason for that was because he was greatly impacted, and one would say born again, or came into a relationship with God through the ministry and the word of David Davies, who was a famous Welsh revivalist. Now, we talk about the Welsh revival, and many of the time we're talking about the 1904 revival in Wales, a huge one. But there was many prior revivals too, and David Davies was part of that. But so too is Christmas Evans, as you'll hear in a minute. And so he was an itinerant, the itinerant Calvinistic Methodist preachers and the members of the Baptist Church at Clandissul further influenced him, and he soon joined the latter denomination. That's the Baptists. In 1789, he went into North Wales as a preacher and settled for 2 years on the remote Lynn Peninsula in Carnarvonshire, from where he moved to Clongeffney in Anglesey. Now, here's an interesting one, because he was a Baptist, right? They said it was a Baptist church up there at Anglesey, you know, where Holyhead is, that little island up there. And they gave him a manse. He was just married to his wife. Amazingly, married on Christmas Day as well. Isn't that nice? And they lived in this humblest of humble cottages. In fact, He was about 6 foot tall himself, but the ceiling of this cottage was less than 6 foot, so he never got to stand upright in his own house, but he never complained all the years he was there. So that tells you something of the man. And another thing worth noting about him is he was disfigured through blindness. He was blind in one eye, and he looked, when he stood up in front of a crowd, in fact, it hindered him in the early part of his ministry from stepping out, because he knew his appearance was disfigured. And we know someone else who had a disfigured appearance, who read about him in Isaiah 52. Yep. So anyway, how did he get his blind eye? Well, the story was that before he knew the Lord, he lived a pretty rough life and kept bad company. And then after he came to know Jesus Christ, there were six of his former mates got him one night in the dark, and with sticks they brutally beat him. And in that incident, he lost the sight of one eye. So we've often spoke about the persecuted church here on God Talk, and here's a living example of well, he's not living anymore, but an example of somebody who was so persecuted that he bore that scar for the rest of his life. And even in some accounts, he was in pain and he needed special ointment that he'd wipe on his blind eye before preaching. So with all of that gone through, I want to talk a little bit about his style of preaching. And, you know, so frequently, like David Reynolds and Howell Harris, another famous name from Wales, before him, he preached outside of doors and frequently found his congregation bathed in tears. Remarkable was the change in the religious life of the district, from coldness and deadness to life and power. And of books he had few. He had his Bible, possibly some of Bunyan's works, that's John Bunyan, and a borrowed Welsh-English dictionary, and Burkett on the New Testament commentary, which he would study in bed at night, looking up all the hard words in the dictionary. And in Lynn, Christmas Evans was strongly influenced by a guy called Robert Roberts. He was a popular preacher whose preaching was followed by marked effects. He was also a man of prayer, and that can definitely be said of set of Christmas Evans, how he would deeply pray before he'd preach. Christmas Evans was once asked if he could give any reason for how he came into his unusual way of preaching. And this is what he said. "Yes, I can, partly at least. I had the ideas before, but somehow couldn't get at them. When I was in Lynn, the Methodists," that's the Calvinistic Methodists, "had a preacher of the name of Robert Roberts, of Clanifney, who was very popular. And there was a great deal of talk about him. Well, I went on one Sunday afternoon to hear him, and he was one of the most insignificant looking persons I ever saw, a little hunchback man. But he neither thought nor said anything like other people there. There was something wonderful and uncommon about him. This Robert Roberts gave me the key." And I maybe ask, what was Christmas Evans' peculiar way of preaching? And we're going to go to an example here. This is where he talks about Saul of Tarsus and his seven ships. Well, in fact, I'm not going to read that. I'm going to skip over to another one here, which I have is probably his most famous preaching. And this preaching is it's about a graveyard. And let's just have a listen to this.
"Methinks," exclaimed the impassioned preacher, "I find myself standing upon the summit of one of the highest of the everlasting hills, permitted from thence to take a survey of the whole earth. And all before me I see a wide and far spread burial ground, a graveyard, over which lie scattered the countless multitudes of the wretched and perishing children of Adam. The ground is full of hollows, the yawning caverns of death, and over the whole scene broods a thick cloud of darkness. No light from above shines upon it. There is no ray of sun or moon. There is no beam, even of a little candle, seen through all its borders. It is walled all around, But it has gates, large and massive, 10,000 times stronger than all the gates of brass forged among men. They are one and all safely locked. The hand of divine law has locked them, and so firmly secured are the strong bolts that all the created powers, even of the heavenly world, were they to labour to all eternity, could not drive so much as one of them back. How hopeless is the wretchedness to which the race is doomed! Into what irrecoverable depths of ruin has sin plunged the people who sit there in darkness and in the shadow of death? While there, by the brazen gates, stands the inflexible guard, brandishing the flaming sword of undeviating law. But see, in the cool of the day, there is one descending from the eternal hills in the distance. It is Mercy, the radiant form of Mercy, seated in the chariot of divine promise. She comes through the worlds of the universe. She pauses here to mark the imprisoned and grave-like aspect of our once fair world. Her eye affected her heart as she beheld the misery and heard the cry of despair borne upon the four winds of heaven. She could not pass by nor pass on. She wept over the melancholy scene, and she said, "Oh, that I might enter! I would bind up their wounds. I would relieve their sorrows. I would save their souls. An embassy of angels, commissioned from heaven to some other world, paused at the sight, and heaven forgave that pause. They saw Mercy standing by the gate, and they cried, 'Mercy, canst thou not enter? Canst thou look upon that world and not pity? Canst thou pity and not relieve?' And in tears, Mercy replied, 'I can see and I can pity, but I cannot relieve.' 'Why dost thou not enter?' inquired the heavenly host. 'Oh,' said Mercy, 'law has barred the gate against me, and I must not and I cannot unbar it.' And law stood there, watching the gate. And the angels asked of him, 'Why wilt thou not suffer Mercy to enter?' And he said, 'No one can enter here and live.' And the thunder of his voice outspoke the wailings within. Then again I heard Mercy cry, 'Is there no entrance for me into this field of death? May I not visit these caverns of the grave and seek, if it may be, to raise some at least of these children of destruction and bring them to the light of day? Open, Justice, open! Drive back these iron bolts, and let me in, that I may proclaim the jubilee of redemption to the children of the dust.' And then I heard Justice reply, 'Mercy, surely thou lovest Justice too well to wish to burst these gates by force of arm, and thus to obtain entrance by lawless violence. I cannot open the door. I am not angry with these unhappy ones. I have no delight in their death or in hearing their cries as they lie upon the burning hearth of the great fire kindled by the wrath of God in the land that is lower than the grave. But without shedding of blood, there is no remission.' So Mercy expanded her wings, splendid beyond the brightness of the morning when its rays are seen shooting over mountains of pearl. And Mercy renewed her flight amongst the unfallen worlds. She reascended into the mid-air but could not proceed far, because she could not forget the sad sight of the graveyard world, the melancholy prison. She returned to her native throne in the heaven of heavens. It was a glorious high throne, unshaken and untarnished by the fallen fate of men and angels. Even there, she could not forget what she had witnessed, and wept over, and she weighed the woes of the sad world against the doom of eternal law. She could not forget the prison and the graveyard, and she redescended with a more rapid and radiant flight, and she stood again by the gate, but was again denied admission. And the two stood there together, justice and mercy. And justice dropped his brandishing sword while they held converse together. And while they talked, there was silence in heaven. "Is there then no admission on any terms whatever?" she said. "Ah, yes," said Justice, "but then they are terms which no created being can fulfil. I demand atoning death for the eternal life of those who lie in this graveyard. I demand divine life for their ransom." And while they were talking, behold, there stood by them a third form, fairer than the children of men, radiant with the glory of heaven. He cast a look upon the graveyard, and he said to Mercy, "Accept the terms." "Where is the security?" said Justice. "Here," said Mercy, pointing to the radiant stranger, "here is my bond. 4,000 years from hence, demand its payment on Calvary. To redeem men," said Mercy, "I will be incarnate in the Son of God. The Lamb will be slain for the life of this graveyard world." The bond was accepted, and Mercy entered the graveyard, leaning on the arm of Justice. She spoke to the prisoners. Centuries rolled by. So went on the gathering of the first fruits in the field of redemption. Still, ages passed away, and at last the clock of prophecy struck the fullness of time. The bond, which had been committed to patriarchs and prophets, had to be redeemed. A long series of rites and ceremonies, sacrifices and oblations had been instituted to perpetuate the memory of that solemn deed. At the close of the 4,000th year, when Daniel's 70 weeks were accomplished, Justice and Mercy appeared on the hill of Calvary. Angels and archangels, cherubim and seraphim, principalities and powers, left their thrones and mansions of glory and bent over the battlements of heaven, gazing in mute amazement and breathless suspense upon the solemn scene. At the foot of Calvary's hill was beheld the Son of God. "Lo, I come," he said. "I come in the bond it is written of me." He appeared without the gates of Jerusalem, crowned with thorns and followed by the weeping church. It was with him the hour and the power of darkness. Above him were all the vials of divine wrath and the thunders of the eternal law. Round him were all the powers of darkness, the monsters of the pit. Huge, fierce and relentless were there, the lions as a great army, gnashing their teeth, ready to tear him in pieces. The unicorns, a countless host, were rushing towards to thrust him through, and there were the bulls of Bashan, roaring terribly, the dragons of the pit unfolding themselves and shooting out their stings, and dogs, many dogs, all around the mountain. And he passed through this dense array, an unresisting victim, led as a lamb to the slaughter. He took the bond from the hand of Justice, and as he was nailed to the cross, He nailed it to the cross. And all the hosts of hell, though invisible to man, had formed a ring around it. The rocks rent, the sun shrank from the scene, as Justice lifted his right hand to the throne, exclaiming, "Fire of heaven, descend and consume this sacrifice." The fires of heaven, animated with living spirit, answered the call, "We come, we come, and when we have consumed that victim, we will burn the world." They burst, blazed, devoured. The blood of the victim was fast dropping. The hosts of hell were shouting until the humanity of Emmanuel gave up the ghost. The fire went on burning until the ninth hour of the day, but when it touched the deity of the Son of God, it expired. Justice dropped the fiery sword at the foot of the cross, and the Lord joined with the prophets in witnessing to the righteousness which is by faith in the Son of God, for all had heard the dying Redeemer exclaim, "It is finished." The weeping church heard it and lifted up her head, cried too, "It is finished." Attending angels hovering near heard it, and winging their flight they sang, "It is finished." The powers of darkness heard the acclamation of the universe and hurried away from the scene in death-like feebleness. He triumphed over them openly. The graves of the old burial ground have been thrown open, and gales of life have blown over the valley of dry bones. And an exceeding great army has already been sealed to our God as among the living in Zion. For so the bond was paid and eternal redemption secured.
That was one of the world's greatest sermons given by Christmas Evans. It's called "The World as a Graveyard." And I think the message in there, it's a timeless message about what Jesus did for us, how he reconciled the law and grace. Wonderful mercy in the law. Anyway, Christmas Evans, he was a Paul in labour. He was a Bunyan in imagination, and he was a Whitfield in eloquence. So said the Religious Tract Society when they wrote about him. So thank you very much for listening. You've been listening to God Talk. Don't forget to tune in next week, and God bless you all.
This is Near FM
90.3.